Welcome to Parents Perspective. I can't understand it. Jane was looking ruefully at her son Danny's report card. I know he's a smart kid, but you sure wouldn't know it from these grades.
Have you met his teachers yet?
Asked her friend Molly.
Even seventh grade teachers are happy to meet with parents.
It's so weird, Jane mused. At the same age, Susie was getting wonderful grades, and I know he's just as smart as she is. He's the one who could add up the prices of all the items on the grocery list before I could even pay the cashier.
Maybe he's just not doing his work, Molly suggested.
Well, he doesn't sit down at his desk for an hour or two at a time like his sister, that's for sure, Jane noted. But then he's not much for sitting for long periods anyway.
It's a shame, Molly added. There aren't special desks for boys where they could just stand up and walk around all day.
From a parent's perspective, what should we know about the difference between boys and girls in academics? I'm Sandy Burt.
And I'm Linda Perlis. Today's guest has had experience with this subject. Dr. Marshall Poe taught for years at Harvard University before taking a position at the Atlantic Monthly, where he currently serves as an editorial analyst specializing in social, educational, and family policy. His most recent article was The Other Gender Gap: Maybe Boys Just Weren't Meant for the Classroom. Welcome to Parents Perspective, Marshall.
Thanks very much for having me.
We frequently hear that boys don't do as well in school as girls. Why would you say this is so?
Well, interestingly, I think that the intuitive answer, the one that probably most of your listeners know, is the correct one, and that is because boys, and specifically young boys, fidget a lot. They're rather more rambunctious than girls. And although we like to think that the classroom is gender neutral, it's really not. It's designed to reward the kinds of behaviors that girls are more likely to engage in. For example, focusing, concentration, the ability to sit for long periods of time, that sort of thing. You know, just to sit in your seat and do your work. Boys are less able to do this for largely dispositional reasons.
It's interesting. I read a long time ago that someone said our educational system in this country is based on the factory model. The idea is you go in, you do what you're supposed to do day after day after day, and you come out with a product.
Well, it's true that it is. I mean, the economy of scale that you have to have in order to teach all these kids is such that you can't give every one of them individual attention. So because we have gender mixed classrooms, we don't really have special techniques that we use for boys and for girls. And the unfortunate fact of the matter is that the way in which pedagogy is structured favors girls because they are of a quieter disposition than boys. Now, this is, of course, on average, not in specific cases. You're going to find lots of boys who are perfectly able to do very well. But again, if you look at the statistics, you can see, and we've seen this for a long time, that girls outperform boys on most measures prior to college.
The question that you just raised indirectly was that we have gender-mixed classrooms. Are there studies that have been done on classrooms that are just boys or just girls?
It's a good question. I don't think any rigorous studies have been done, at least not that I found. I know that there are pilot programs in Australia and in the UK, and there's even one in the United States in which gender-divided or segregated classrooms have been created and are being studied. It's a very partisan issue, and so you'll find people who will produce quote-unquote research that is not terribly convincing if they advocate segregation or if they don't like it. So I wouldn't really feel comfortable saying anything particular about it, except that boys and girls learn differently. That much we know. How to teach them, we don't really know.
If they do have equal abilities, though, why are so many boys categorized with learning problems?
Well, I think part of the reason, again, has to do with this kind of rambunctiousness. I know my mom was a junior high school teacher for her whole life. She just recently retired. And she would tell me that there had to be some place to put problem boys. They get bigger faster, and they're scary. And so it's often the case, I think, that they're vented into special education classes because they have behavioral problems, not necessarily academic problems. These two things are linked, of course, and we should think of them as linked. Because literally the ability to sit in a chair and be quiet is an important aspect of learning in our current system. So I think that the direct answer to your question is, unfortunately, that boys are being funneled into special ed classes because they're having behavioral problems. They won't sit still, and teachers can't devote all their attention to these kids that demand all of their time.
Sandy and I know that from our own experience as former teachers.
Oh, is that right? Yeah, that's
we
right.
We both had boys like that in our
right.
classes.
Yeah, you don't really know what to do with them. I mean, you know, and I was kind of one of them myself. And I remember when I was in junior high, the vice principal told me he had a special chair for me because I was in there so often because
oh,
the
dear.
Vice principal was the disciplinarian. So I think that's the answer.
Well, it's interesting. I remember from my days as a teacher of middle school kids, I had one class where it was all boys. And all of them, to get into this particular class, had to have failed at least once.
Yeah.
So they were all oversized guys,
yeah.
and they all had terrible trouble sitting in the chairs.
Mm-hmm.
Even if the chairs had been big enough,
mm-hmm.
they had terrible trouble. So we had people sitting on shelves and on
sure.
desktops and everything. And sure. it was interesting when I was trying to explain this to somebody, I remember sort of analogizing that boys of a certain stage have difficulty sitting down because their muscles feel like we all feel when we've been in a movie theater
yeah.
for over 2 hours.
Yeah, yeah, that's possibly true. I mean, it certainly is the case. I can't go into the sort of physiological differences between the sort of young boys and young girls' sort of brains and things like this. But we know that, you know, there are certain chemicals that they have more of, testosterone, for example, that do cause a sort of heightened amount of activity and desire for activity. There's no question about it. I mean, it's used for doping in sports, for example. So there's no doubt that there are these native differences. And I think one difficulty in American culture, generally speaking, at least its pedagogical aspect, is that we, for such a long time, didn't accept that boys and girls are really different.
All you have to do is think about the years when everybody had to learn handwriting.
Right.
Immediately.
Right.
You could tell the very first
yeah.
paper.
No, it's true.
It's true.
In other places, you know, they also have these problems, that is this differential between the performance of boys and girls. But they have been much more quick to address it because they think the notion that boys and girls learn the same or are the same is silly. Whereas we seem to be very sort of wedded to this idea of complete and utter equality on all levels. It's a political issue in the United States. It's a big political issue, and there are powerful forces behind this kind of thing. But from a pedagogical standpoint, as you guys know, it don't make a lot of sense. You just can't. I remember when Title IX was introduced, and I was in junior high. And
you
all
have
of a sudden,
explain what that is.
Title IX, which mandated, at least as I understand it,
sources.
Equal allocation of resources for boys and girls, and I was in junior high. And what this meant for us was we had co-ed gym class now for the first time. And this was silly. I mean, it just didn't make any sense to anyone. Nobody understood it. And we used to walk around scratching our heads because it just didn't work out very well.
Certainly the gym uniforms were not any good.
Well, no, the gym uniforms were terrible. But I remember, you know, and it's that kind of, you know, the notion that men and women should be competing with one another athletically is sort of, it symbolizes our mania for this kind of
thing.
Well,
it's interesting. I have a high school student who's about to graduate, but he was on the wrestling team for a number of years. And where we live, the schools had competitions with co-ed wrestling. Now, of course, their weight class divided,
yeah,
but
I don't know what that
still,
could be.
I mean, that was
yeah, that is,
really
yeah.
bizarre.
Yeah. It is this kind of politicization of the issue. They're kind of making it, trying to get political mileage out of it that I think is largely responsible for this unfortunate effect.
Yeah. Now, we haven't talked too much about the teen years except for the wrestling part.
Mm-hmm.
Do you find that boys are at an educational disadvantage at that point developmentally?
They're at an educational disadvantage at every moment from kindergarten basically through graduate school, to be honest with you. The ways in which they're disadvantaged are slightly different. In the teen years, one problem is the labor market draws a lot of them off. About 70% of people graduate from high school in normal time. The Education Department publishes a different statistic, but they don't count people in jail and stuff like that. They fiddle with the numbers. But the fact of the matter is that more girls graduate from high school than boys, or they graduate at a greater rate, let's put it that way. And the difference is 3 or 4 points, which is pretty significant. And the reason has to do both with academic difficulties that boys have, but also, and this is an extrinsic factor that really doesn't affect girls as much, they're drawn into the labor market because you can go work as a day laborer and make pretty decent money on a building site. You know, I did this in high school. I had a job all through high school. Mm. I worked 30 hours a week as a driver. These opportunities are not available, quote unquote, to girls, nor are they expected to work in most environments. They work in the Gap or whatever happens to be. But the way in which you can kind of move up the ladder in a blue-collar job is quite different from your job at the Gap or at the Dairy Queen. You can actually get to $12 or $15 an hour as an apprentice on a building site. So you're 18 and you're thinking to yourself, am I going to go to college? Am I going to graduate from high school? I'm making $15 an hour. Why would I want to do that? Because you're not really thinking, well, the return to education is really great, and I'll be making a lot more when I'm 30.
We'll take a short break now and be right back to continue our discussion on academic performance of boys versus girls.
Washington, D.C. with Kids, an excellent book by authors Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis, is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
Welcome back to Parents' Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Marshall Poe about academic performance of boys versus girls.
Well, you're saying that even in college and graduate school,
yeah, that's
there's a big
amazing
difference. And we were going to ask you if this, the old higher education gap that we always heard about, still exists.
No, it's gone. It's been gone since the 70s, actually. And this has gotten some news recently, but our focus has been in other places. That is the difference between men and women in terms of, for example, their salaries. That does still exist. There still is a salary gap. Women in doing the same work as men earn less often. That is still true. However, since the 70s, more women have graduated from college than men. Today, about 60%, I think it's 56% of all undergraduates are female. They graduate on time more often. They tend to go to more selective schools than men do. It's quite remarkable because there are affirmative action programs for men. You don't think about it this way, but if, I don't know, take any very selective school, if a Dartmouth or something like that just took people on the merits and didn't try to get gender equity, it'd be 70% female.
Is that right?
Yeah, it would be 70%
kind
female.
Kind of neat coming from a seven-sister school. I'm delighted to hear that about Dartmouth.
But that's true, and in many campuses, on many campuses, they didn't institute this program to get more men in. It's a really interesting story. It's a marketing ploy because for a long time, these colleges didn't have this program. So the numbers of women were going way, way up until they reached 60 or 70%. But they discovered they couldn't attract the best female candidates because they didn't want to go to a school that was 70% female. So they found that in order to get the best female applicants, they had to get more men. I think it's quite a remarkable
Isn't
story. This was told
amazing.
To me by Yeah, it is. Yes, they had to get more men. So
who told you about it?
It was an admissions counselor.
That's
one of these schools.
Hilarious.
Yeah, it's a marketing ploy, basically.
When one of my sons was in medical school, 54% of his class was female. And that's recent years.
Yeah.
I thought
and,
that was interesting.
Well, to go on a little bit, so they graduate from high school at higher rates. They go on to college at higher rates. They complete college at higher rates. They go to graduate school at higher rates. Since the 80s, there have been more higher degrees given to women than men. I mean, it is a quite remarkable turn of events because if you think about it, in the 1950s, it was just exactly the opposite.
Absolutely.
So there's been a huge revolution in higher education.
That interesting.
And so when we think about the gender gap, we still kind of reflexively think that girls are disadvantaged, but in fact, it is just definitely the opposite at every stage. Now, you want to be careful with this, obviously. There's still a lot of discrimination and there's a lot of sexism in higher education. I mean, I spent a lot of years there, and I know that it exists. I wouldn't downplay that for a second. But if you just look at the raw numbers, women are achieving at a higher level than men.
Why do they finish college at a higher rate and go into graduate school at a higher rate?
The answer to the first question is same answer, I think, as explains the difference between high school graduation rates. Men are drawn off by the labor market. It's also the case that if say an 18, 19, 20, 21-year-old gets married who has just graduated from high school or is in college, that person almost doesn't have a choice but to go to work, especially if there's a child involved. I mean, think about it. Young couple, 22, they have their first child, they're both in school. Let's imagine they're both in college. One of them has to work. Who has the higher earning potential? Mm-hmm. It's the man at that level for that kind of work. So he goes to work. The chance that he'll go back to college, very low, because he'll get on a track. He needs that money. That money comes in. That income has to come every month, especially if there's another kid. Think about it that way. Now look at it from the wife's perspective. She has this child. Now she's going to be required to take care of the child probably. She's going to be a stay-at-home mom. She might work as well. Most young mothers do work now. What is the chance that she's going to go back to school? It's actually pretty good. And higher education, that is, adult education, is completely dominated by women. And it's basically, my kid goes to school now, and I'm going to finish my degree, or I'm going to go get that master's of science that I always wanted, and they go back to school, and then they reenter the labor force.
And we both did that.
Mm-hmm. I mean, it's it's very, very common. But if you turn the equation around and you look at men, they don't go back. The money has to come, and they're not going to stay home.
It's interesting. We need an industrial GI Bill, so to speak.
Sort of, yeah, we do. What we really need is really good. This is sort of my own hobby horse. What we really need is really good health care. And childcare as part of that. Childcare would be very helpful.
Marshall, what would you say some of the long-term implications are of these facts?
Well, let me start with sort of middle-term implications.
Okay.
One that you don't hear a lot about is a problem with what we call the marriage market. People tend to marry people of roughly the same educational accomplishment as themselves. What that means is when there are more women with college degrees than men, you have a lot of women that go looking. And there are no mates for them. We've seen this in the African-American community for a long time because the disparity between college graduates, and even high school graduation rates, among African-Americans is much greater than it is among other racial cohorts. I don't remember the statistics, but it's quite shocking. Something like twice as many black women graduate from college as men. So this is a lot of women looking for mates. Mm. They're available, and certainly people can, you know, marry outside their group or outside their race or ethnicity or whatever. But the fact of the matter is we also know that this group of people tends to get married at a much lower rate. So, in fact, it's happening now. The percentage of African-American women with college degrees who are married is much lower than it is among, say, for example, white women.
So that has implications for the next group coming up of
African-American
children.
Absolutely does.
It's going to be a much tinier
right.
group.
Well, you want to pass these values on. If your best predictor if you're going to go to college is if your parents went to college, right? So if your mom went to college, that's a good thing. But if your mom never has you because she couldn't find a suitable husband, then that's a big
you don't
problem.
Get to go.
I'm most interested in the rate of economic growth. I mean, we live in what we call an information economy now, and the amount that you get back by investing in education has never been greater. Staying in school is really the only way to get into the middle class these days. You won't make it unless you at least graduate from high school and probably graduate from college. You can do very well, and America's a wonderful place to live for everyone. But if you want to live a middle class life, you need a college education. And the economy requires these people. We have to have them, and we have to have more of them every year. And the problem here is that the number of men who are graduating from college is not rising very much. It's rising extremely slowly. Now, the number of women who are graduating from college is going up very rapidly, and it continues to go up. And this has really taught us something very important, because we thought that the percentage of men who went on to college and graduated was kind of at its natural limit, that there's just that percentage of people who can go on and do this. And the experience of women has told us that's just false. A lot higher percentage of men could be going to college but aren't. The important thing is that at some point, probably in your 20s or 30s, you get a college education. And we know that a lot of men are making a bad decision. They're foregoing the decision to go to college for a job that makes $8, $10, $12, $15 an hour. It's not a prudent bargain, really. Mm. And not only are they suffering, but we're all suffering, because the point is there's what we call excess capacity here. These men could be doing more productive work. We want to send them to college. We need them. We need them if the economy is going to continue to grow. And here's the trick, actually, and this gets back to child care. We're pouring more of our educational resources as a percentage into the female population, but the female population is drawn off in its 20s by childbearing. They don't work. They get all this fancy education. They're extremely well-trained, not always, obviously, but a lot of them don't work because they choose to raise children, or they're forced to raise children, or whatever circumstances are such that they raise children. So you can think about it like we're investing a lot of money in this cohort of people that for 10 years don't work.
So it's a delayed return, basically.
Yeah, right. They don't work. And the men who are not going to college at the same rate and have this excess capacity. I mean, we're not making up for this group that's been lost for that time period. That's exactly right. So if you kind of think about it like that, it's like we're investing in this resource and it's not returning the way it could. So if we had good childcare, for example, all those very highly educated women could go into the workforce. And when they went into the workforce, the economy would grow and we'd all be richer.
And
they would pay for the child care.
The moral of the story.
They would pay for the child care.
That's right.
But I mean, I can't tell you how many women who I know who are just in this, just right in their 20s and early 30s, who are just in this boat. You know, they graduate from these good schools. They're very bright. They have all these skills. And they want to have children. And, you know, it's
complex. We'll take a short break now and be right back to finish our discussion on academic performance of boys versus girls.
For an audio cassette copy of any parent's perspective show, send a check or money order for $5 with your name, address, and phone number to Parents Perspective, P.O. Box 42283, Washington, D.C., 20015.
Welcome back to Parents Perspective. We're talking with Dr. Marshall Poe of the Atlantic Monthly about academic performance of boys versus girls. What kinds of changes do you think adults should be promoting in their children's classrooms?
That's a good question. I'm not quite sure I'm the right person to answer it, but I think the far and away the most important thing a parent can do is recognize that there is this difference between the way boys and girls learn. It does nobody any good to pretend that doesn't exist. And then I guess a further step is to make sure that your teachers know that's true. You know, God forbid your rambunctious 9-year-old gets put in special ed just because he's kind of rambunctious. You know, you should be very careful about this kind of thing. Beyond that, in terms of specific things that you can do to sort of raise the educational achievement of a somewhat wayward boy, let's say, you know, I don't really have anything specific to say except just encourage them to stay in school. Tell them at every moment that they need this and will need it later. There's no bargain they can make today that will be as good as the one that they get when they get out of college.
I think it's crucial for parents to be on the scene, be able to advocate for their kids wherever there's an opportunity.
That's exactly right.
And they have to know what's going on in the classroom.
Well, they should.
Be on site.
Yeah, they absolutely should. Schools, as far as I know, do publish the results of these national achievement tests, which kids are given at, I don't remember, it's 3rd and 6th and 9th. And so you can find out if your school has a big difference in achievement between boys and girls. And if it does, then you know there's a problem. I mean, the school district should tell you about these things, right? So you know that if you fall way outside the national average, if boys are really not doing well, there's something about that school that is not doing them any favors, if you see exactly what I mean.
The other thing is, I think whenever there's an economic crunch in a community, what's the first thing to go on the budget? Oh, yes, things like recess, which, of course, the children don't need, the theory, which we all know is really, really bad.
That's absolutely true. A lot of recess is a good thing, particularly for boys. And I know that even music programs have been cut, which is it's hard to believe. I mean, it truly is astounding we could have school systems without music programs. So, yeah, these things are extremely important. Boys need to vent. And so when they want to play Little League and they want to go out to recess or play the saxophone or something, they need to go do that. My mom always used to say, go play in the traffic.
Keep yourself nice and busy.
Yeah.
Well, one of the things Linda and I have always advocated, and we've raised only boys, is how very important it is for everybody, but kids particularly coming up, to feel that they're good at something. And if there's no place in a whole school day for a kid to feel he's good at something, you've got a recipe for a dropout.
That's extremely important advice, I think, for anyone. It's important to keep telling your son that he needs to really stay in school. It's not about getting A's or knocking the SAT dead. You know, the difference between a person that doesn't graduate from college and a person who does is much larger. The difference between someone who goes to, you know, really selective school A and the local U. There is a difference there. It isn't that big, but between someone who's a high school graduate and college, it's huge, just huge. So,
yeah. Well, that's where role models come in as well.
Yeah, that's in my own experience. I went to college to play basketball, and I'd never met a PhD before. I don't think I'd ever heard anyone speak a foreign language. I grew up in Kansas, and I met a guy there, Dan Kaiser, who became my advisor, and he was sort of my role model. I'm still in touch with him all the time. Yeah, I mean, I email him and we talk on the phone, and yeah, so that's exactly right.
All you guys out there listening, you can be a role model for somebody. It's very, very important.
And my basketball career didn't take off.
Oh, well. Well, it's good to have something to fall back on.
I wasn't very good at that.
Like a doctorate.
Yeah, I wasn't very good at that.
Well, at this point, we like to leave parents with any kind of resources that we can for further use. What would you suggest?
There is an author named Christina Hoff Summers who's written pretty widely on these things. She has several books and magazine articles. If you have internet access and you Google her, you'll certainly find a lot of things that she's written. There are resource pages that are put out on this thing on the web again. There's a fellow named Tom Mortensen who runs research unit in Iowa called the Post-Secondary Educational Achievement Council or something like this. But if you type in post-secondary in Mortensen, you'll find him. He does really excellent work on these things. There are other more specific tools for pedagogues and teachers. I don't know much about them. I know there are books out there that at least claim to give teachers tools that they can use in the classroom to help boys. So I know they exist. I can't really tell you what they are, though. I'm sorry.
It's all right. We have a good start, and that's important. We have opened up a very important issue, and we are so glad to have had you with us today to help us, Dr. Marshall Poe. Thanks so much.
Thank you very much for having me. I appreciate it.
Our gift for our first caller is an autographed copy of our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids. Just call us toll-free at 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address. That's 1-800-791-8573 with your name and mailing address and mention show number 221. Tell us if you can what station you are listening to. Since we're airing all over the world, it's always fun to know what station you are tuning into. Washington, D.C. with Kids is available at all major bookstores and on the web.
To learn more about Parents Perspective and our latest book, Washington, D.C. with Kids, visit our website, www.parentsperspective.org. That's www.parentsperspective.org. This is Sandy Burt and Linda Perlis. We're glad you could share Parents' Perspective. Our sound engineer is Andrea Tokic. Music for this program was composed and performed by Jonathan Burt.